Life can always use more Cedar Point. And right now, you can get more Cedar Point for less with the Fun Day Bundle for just $74.99. Each bundle gets you admission, parking, and all-day dining for one low price. That means more coasters like Steel Vengeance and more nostalgic fun in the boardwalk area. But you better hurry because this bundle won't last. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 3 of True Crime Tuesday. Last week, we ended the show by giving an example of how sex, in general, can taint our perspective on individuals, situations, and even murder. If we look at the infamous case of the Yorkshire Ripper, he is believed to have turned his attention to prostitutes for two reasons. One, he saw them as vulnerable. And two, he knew just how ambivalent the attitude of the police would be towards the murder and rape of a prostitute compared to that, say, of a teacher. And we all may be thinking right now, well, what a horrible individual he was. And you wouldn't be wrong. But the thing is, his thoughts on the ambivalence towards sex workers is something the majority of the country have. That's why at the end of last week's show, when we talked about Gareth Williams, the codebreaker, who was found in a suitcase that he'd zipped himself into, which was proven in court to be impossible to do, they decided to leak information to the press about how he visited bondage sites. And therefore, the nation looked away. And by looking away, they were allowed to pass a death by misadventure verdict. However, as suspicion grew, an inquest was demanded. At this point, you're probably thinking, what the hell does this have to do with the alleged Marconi murders? But today, we're going to look at two of the deaths related to the alleged Marconi murders that deal with sex. Or should I say, more specifically, autoerotic asphyxiation, which basically means in layman's terms a theory that when you cut off some oxygen to the brain, it will intensify the feeling of your orgasm. Cutting off oxygen to the brain? Well, that sounds awfully dangerous. Surely someone could die doing that. And imagine the embarrassment, the shame, the guilt even, that you would feel as a member of that family, knowing your loved one died doing some bizarre experiment to try and get a good orgasm. How horrific. Double so if it makes the press. God knows if it makes the media or the national news. Their name will be dragged through the mud forevermore. And everything they ever done or achieved will always be tarnished. And they'll never be believed for anything they done or said, because ultimately they were a dirty little pervert. Well done. That's the entire idea. That's the trap that these people who commit these suicides on people want you to fall into. And we do. Interestingly, one person who was brave enough to stand above the public outrage and moral despair was the coroner at the inquest. Because they ruled that they were satisfied on the balance of probabilities that Gareth was killed unlawfully. That's now law. That's the cause of his death. An unlawful killing. This brave coroner then turned their attention to the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, where Gareth worked as a codebreaker. The coroner criticised the SIS for not reporting Gareth missing for 7 full days. They also rejected any notion of suicide or interest in bondage or cross-dressing or autoerotic activity being involved. and they condemned all of the leaks about cross-dressing as a possible attempt at media manipulation. The coroner then turned to address the Met Police terrorism team and stated they'd mishandled the unit's investigation, condemning the fact they'd failed to take any formal statements from a single member of staff from the SIS, leading them to go so far as to suggest the SIS may be involved in the death itself, and that should be a legitimate line of inquiry for the police. So, tail between their legs, the Met allegedly put their best minds on the task for 12 full months. And with unfettered access to the SIS, their staff, and any of Gareth's files, they came to the incredible conclusion that the most probable scenario was that he died alone in his flat in central London, as a result of accidentally locking himself inside the bag. Thankfully, the coroner has the final say in terms of cause of death, not the Met Police. Therefore, lawfully, legally, the cause of death for Gareth is unlawful killing, implying murder. For a 12-month alleged thorough investigation to result in the same conclusion that resulted in the need for an inquest implies, to me anyway, in my opinion, that somebody has been told what their findings are going to be. And this was the point I was making in earlier episodes when I was saying we need to question what we believe is actually true when coming from the mouths of someone simply because they're in uniform. What we're doing at the start of this episode is sowing a narrative so that you can see the pattern, and then we will jump back to the 80s. But I think it's vital that we understand what we're going to be talking about. You may have picked up from that story alone where we're heading, but I don't think yet you understand just how deep this rabbit hole goes. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Kev Eustace, and this is episode 3, Diversionary Deaths. Before we go to our two victims within the Marconi conspiracy, we're going to make sure everyone's aware of the fuller picture of this idea of being suicided via autoerotic asphyxiation. It's 1994, February the 7th, and rising Tory MP Stephen Milligan, a 45-year-old man at the height of his career owning a lovely home in Chiswick, has just been found dead, naked in the kitchen, wearing a pair of women's stockings and suspenders. He has a black bin liner over his head, and around his neck is a piece of electrical flex, which apparently he'd used to try and strangle himself. In the meanwhile, he also took the time to put a slice of orange in his mouth. A very hastily convened inquest concluded what you would expect. The West London coroner, John Burton, found no evidence to suggest that the MP had been murdered or committed suicide, instead recording an official verdict of death by misadventure. But here's the thing. People have friends. People have really close friends. They know how they think. They know how they operate. They have no secrets. And one of Milligan's friends was none other than veteran BBC news reporter John Simpson. And he floated the idea that this had nothing to do with a bizarre sexual experiment, but was actually part of a cover-up. He's quoted as saying, "What better way to kill someone without there being any form of investigation than this?" And it would appear that Simpson's theory was validated by a man named Gerald James. Now, Gerald James owned a firm called Astra, and they got caught up in the arms to Iraq scandal. Astra was allegedly knowingly selling weapons that they knew would end up in the hands of Saddam Hussein. But James turned whistleblower and said he was only one of many companies whose activities had been quietly sanctioned by the British government. The Scott Report of 1996 validated many of his claims, arguably making him untouchable. And he's very much still alive today. He even published a memoir titled In the Public Interest. In this memoir, James suggests that the Tory MP Stephen Milligan was only one of up to eight individuals killed in eerily coincidental circumstances by the government security services to stop information of the government's involvement in illegal arms sales becoming public. Another of the eight was an MI6 officer turned journalist, James Rusbridger, who died 9 days after writing to a TV station saying he wanted to investigate the death of the Tory MP. And I say died. I should say he was found laying on the upstairs hallway of his home in green overalls, thick rubber gloves, wearing a gas mask and a long oilskin coat. He had a rope that was tied around both ankles and his neck, which spiraled up to the attic. His corpse was surrounded by pictures of men and women in bondage. The coroner? Well, let's guess. If you guessed death by misadventure, well done you, give yourself a pat on the back. Then another, we have Jonathan Moyle, a journalist who went to Chile in 1990 to look into 50 helicopters which were bound for Iraq. Oh, only after they'd been fitted with British-made anti-tank missile guidance systems. And Moyle's report is very concerning. Concerning because his pen never reached the paper. Instead, he was found jammed into his hotel wardrobe, hung by his shirt from the wardrobe rail, a pillowcase over his head. Oh, and he decided to don two pairs of underpants, wrap himself in a towel, and, as you do, then wrap himself in a polythene bag. The British Embassy said his death was a sex game gone wrong. Ultimately, the favourite phrase of the day, death by misadventure. And it took a full 8 years of his name being besmirched, dragged through the mud, his family humiliated, before finally an inquest stated that Moyle had been unlawfully killed by a person or persons unknown. He was also engaged to be married. And his mourning fiancé is quoted as saying, "The British intelligence services tried to smear Jonathan, suggesting he was a sexual deviant." In Gerald James's memoir, he claims that staging deaths via autoerotic asphyxiation was a favourite technique of secret agents. Why? Well, we're British. We're prudes. A man dying, pleasuring himself. Ugh, that's on him. That's what the man in the street says. Ergo, the death is unlikely to be properly investigated. And as the BBC journalist John Simpson put it regarding the death of the Tory MP, many people thought it was funny, or savage, or they were just too embarrassed to have anything to do with it. And that's the very thing. That's why it works. But the death of MP Stephen Milligan was in 1994. But let's not think that this was not already a long-standing method of assassination. Especially in the less forensic timescale that we're looking at. But before we leave 1994 and step back into the so-called Marconi murders, here's a very interesting fact that only further muddies the narrative. You see, in 94, a tribunal heard that MI5 agents have legal authorization to commit, and I quote, "murder, torture, and sexual assault on British soil without fear of prosecution in order to protect national security." But that's 1994, you may say, and we're dealing with the mid-80s. Well, it was also revealed that this immunity had been in place for the previous 30 years. But let's just think on that. And I'm smiling as I say this because it's so ridiculous. There is a law that gives certain people in this country immunity from murder, from torture, and from sexual assault in order to protect national security. Now, I've heard the phrase, as we all have, one rule for one rule for others, meaning an unfairness in society. Well, I think that's what we'd call that, especially if the national security that we're referring to is when our own government is giving weapons to the enemy that we are fighting. And that will all come down to money once again. Just like it was money that brought the contracts for the Star Wars program in via Ronald Reagan to Thatcher, despite her disagreeing with the entire ethos behind the project, it just proves one thing. They give you the fallacy, they give you the illusion of free choice, of democracy, of you being able to be part of the decisions which move the country in one direction or another. When in reality, the only thing that does that is the mighty dollar. So now I think we've established where we're aiming in today's episode. I think it's time to pick back up with our Marconi trail. Now, the related deaths we'll look at today are both from 1987. The issue is, this autoerotic asphyxiation method was carried out twice within 4 months, January and April of 87. Now, given the coincidences picked up by the media of Vimal and Sharif from our last episode, did they slip up, putting these so close together? They may well have thought not, because, by the way, in those 4 months, aside from the two deaths we'll cover today, there were a further 7 deaths, which we'll be sure to cover in future episodes. But today, we'll be looking at the deaths of Richard Pugh, who died in January of 87, and was a computer consultant for the Ministry of Defence, and also the death of Mark Wisner, a software engineer at the Ministry of Defence Experimental Station for Combat Aircraft.
Life can always use more Cedar Point. And right now, you can get more Cedar Point for less with the Fun Day Bundle for just $74.99. Each bundle gets you admission, parking, and all-day dining for one low price. That means more coasters like Steel Vengeance and more nostalgic fun in the boardwalk area. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
By the end of 1986, Richard Pugh had made a name for himself as an amazing computer consultant, especially in his particular niche of programming systems designed for military defence, which unsurprisingly caught the eye of the MOD, or the Ministry of Defence, to which he became a contractor. His reputation was solid in the industry, and he was involved in various high-profile projects. And therefore, as a contractor, he was no stranger to the different working styles of government versus private corporations. So when Thatcher was talking about the brightest minds in Britain to work on the Star Wars program, Pugh would have been one of those people she was referring to. And with rumours abound of large amounts of money being thrown at people to help with this secret project that was on its way to the UK shores, as the new year was brought in for 1987, Richard Pugh found himself with the world at his feet. But only 16 short days later, Pugh's body would be found in his London flat on January the 16th. And replacing the world at his feet was a rope. A rope that wrapped itself around his feet, his legs, his thighs, his waist, his arms, right up to his neck, where it looped around 4 times. And he also had a black plastic bag over his head. It was a colleague of Pew's who became concerned after Pew failed to show up for several scheduled meetings and didn't respond to any phone calls. Upon managing to get into the apartment, they found Pew as described. And quite naturally, this led to a phone call to the police. On arrival, the police immediately assumed asphyxiation. Or should I say, autoerotic asphyxiation. There were no immediate signs of a struggle or forced entry into the apartment, which, if it was foul play, would suggest that Pew may have known his assailant, or he willingly participated in whatever led to his death. Now, to be fair to the Met, they did launch an extensive investigation, and they looked at his professional ties and projects, the work he was doing. They delved into his professional life to see if there were any projects or clients that might have posed a risk. However, they would not have been privy to any information regarding the Star Wars program. But they did look into the possibility of industrial espionage, given the sensitive nature of his work. They looked at his personal life and scrutinized it to see if there was any personal motive behind his death. Friends and family were all interviewed, his social circles mapped out to identify any conflicts or threats, and they drew a blank. Everyone, as you'd guess, was in shock. This was not the man they knew. Robert was a courteous, polite, and thoroughly professional man. And whilst these investigations were all hitting dead ends, the forensic team examined the crime scene for any physical evidence that could lead to a perpetrator. The rope which bound his body, the plastic bag over his head, they were both analysed for fingerprints, DNA, and any other clues. But nothing was ever found. The case attracted significant media attention, partly because of the mysterious circumstances and partly because of Pew's professional background. The speculation in the press ranged from theories of an elaborate murder to, yep, you've guessed, sexual deviancy. So, despite the sincere efforts of the Met Police to try and resolve this case, they were unable to definitively determine whether his death was a result of foul play, a targeted hit related to his work, or an unfortunate accident involving an unknown party. But every dead body needs a cause for the death. Therefore, off to the coroner we go. And they take a look at everything laid out in front of them, and they decide the cause of death is an accident. But they hint, probably due to a sexual experiment gone awry. Now, given there was no footprints, fingerprints, DNA of a third party at the apartment, the only way this could be an accident is if Richard Pew was having an affair with someone who knew how to clean a crime scene. So to go along with the coroner's version of events, given the lack of any other evidence that somebody else was in the flat, an expert in cleaning a crime scene is having a legitimate affair with Richard, they engage in some kinky play which accidentally kills Richard. They then fear that they may be a culprit, they clean the crime scene and leave. Now that's about as likely as rocking horse poo. So let's look at what they're actually inferring here. And it's the old cliche. Richard had a sexual deviant personality and had somehow, trying to give himself some sexual gratification, accidentally managed to bind his whole body in rope, including his arms, and then accidentally, somehow, managed to get a plastic bag, place it over his head, and accidentally tighten the rope four times around his neck, using the arms bound to his waist. I do wonder if the internet was a thing back then, if there would have also been leaked stories about bondage and everything else he's not into that they would have implied he was into. Because without going into too much detail, I think we can all imagine if what they're implying took place, there are certain things you need to do, or should I say, there are certain areas you'd need to reach in order to achieve what they allege or what they infer he was attempting to do. But in this case, he was in such a position, he'd be unable to do that. It makes no sense. Similar to Gareth Williams some 20-odd years later. So in that case, though, we have the internet. So they can put out into the press, he is a pervert. And we all look away. But as I say, there's no internet in the 80s, so whoever this assassin was, if that's what took place, of course, it appears they didn't fully grasp the concept of what the outcome was meant to look like. In this case, it would appear that the coroner themselves have acted almost like the internet, with the inference it was a sexual experiment gone wrong. And then we have Mark Wisner. Now, Mark was known to be somewhat of a genius in terms of programming and designing computer programs specifically for combat aircraft for the UK Defence System. So much so, his actual job was to work for the Ministry of Defence at their experimental station for combat aircraft, a highly sensitive position involving the development and testing of advanced military technologies. Therefore, once again, Thatcher's brains of Britain, this guy is more or less at the top of the list. However, in late March, early April of 87, Mark became stressed at work. And the reason for this was some of the programs he had designed from scratch began encountering unexplained technical issues. Ones he had no idea how they could be happening. And he was diligently trying to troubleshoot them. This was as much information as the police could get out of his colleagues, because Wisner's security clearance level was so high. However, he also indicated certain things had raised the stakes of his work. However, there was no more detail given than that. Other than that, his friends and colleagues said he viewed everything as a problem to be solved, and therefore, although he was stressed, there were no signs of depression or any suicidal ideation. Now, the reason the police were there asking these questions was because on the 17th of April, 1987, in his home in Farnborough, Hampshire, a location close to the MOD experimental station, his wife wondered, sitting in bed, why he was taking so long to follow her up the stairs to come to bed. So she went down and tried to find him. Nowhere to be found downstairs, she headed into the garage, where she found Mark hanging from a beam, dangling a few inches from the ground, cling film round his face and a bag over his head. When the emergency services arrived, obviously by this point, Mark was pronounced dead. The police initially assumed suicide. However, even to them, there were several things that just didn't look right. For example, they commented on the position and setup of the body, which appeared too methodical, leading some of them to speculate whether Wisner had been coerced. There was also no note, which is often expected in these cases, although, granted, it's not always present. Further investigations with his colleagues gleaned one more piece of potentially vital information, and that was that there were reports of Wisner being approached by unknown individuals in the weeks leading up to his death. Now, these interactions were deemed suspicious, but they didn't lead to conclusive evidence of foul play. But when the police looked at the overall picture, in arguably one of the most logical ways of thinking that we'll encounter in this series, they posited the idea that this may well be a planned out intricate assassination, indeed an act of espionage, either from an external body or an internal force. But once again, the forensic team were met with a completely clean scene, meaning either A, it was an expert assassination, or B, it was suicide. Despite the concerns of the police, the coroner initially leant towards suicide. However, at an inquest, it was found that the cause of death was an accident due to a sexual experiment gone awry. Are we spotting a pattern yet? I think we are. Now, in next week's episode, we're going to discuss a man by the name of Peter People. Now, interestingly, as we stated about the death of Mark Wisner, the police, when they saw his body, thought something wasn't quite right. It was unnaturally placed. Now, in regards to the death of Peter People, who is one of the deaths in between these two sexual adventures gone awry, accidental deaths, we're expected to believe that Peter managed to get himself into a position that is both logistically almost impossible, but also logically makes no sense, simply to wrap his own mouth around his exhaust pipe. But that's for next time. I hope you enjoyed our look at these diversionary deaths. And don't forget, if you enjoy the show, you can pop over to patreon.com/crimetuesday and you can get these episodes both ad-free and before anyone else. On top of that, we also do a Patreon-only podcast called Cold Case, where we take a look at some of the most famous and infamous unsolved crimes throughout history. So if that sounds like your thing, head over to patreon.com/crimetuesday. And until next week, stay safe and take care.
Save on O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner. Get two cans of O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner for just $8. Valid in-store only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.